Upward mobility through sport. D. Stanley Eitzen. You can trace the history of 20th century immigration in the United States by reading the list of boxers who held the title of champion of the world. The names of Irish, Jewish, Italian, African American, and Latino boxers record the stirrings of upward mobility for those who shared the boxers' ethnicity or nationality, though the lives of the boxers themselves were often far less successful than a championship title would indicate. And what of sports more generally? In true sociological fashion, Stanley Eitzen shows us that sports may do far less in advancing the life chances of young people than is often assumed. Typically, Americans believe that sport is a path to upward social mobility. This belief is based on the obvious examples we see as poor boys and men, rarely girls and women, from rural and urban areas, whether white or black, sometimes skyrocket to fame and fortune through success in sports. Sometimes the financial reward has been astounding, such as the high pay that some African American athletes received in recent years. In 1997, Tracy McGrady, an NBA-bound high school star, bypassed college, signing a $12 million year over 6 years with Adidas. Call for Tiger Woods in his first year as a professional made $6.82 million in winnings, U.S. and worldwide, and appearance fees, plus signed a series of five-year deals with Nike, Titleist, American Express, and Rolex, worth $95.2 million. In 1998, Woods' earnings from endorsements totaled $28 million. Boxer Mike Tyson made $75 million in 1996. It's estimated that Michael Jordan made over $100 million in 1998, including salary, endorsements, and income from merchandise and videos. The recent deals for basketball stars, some exceeding $15 million a year for multi-year contracts, further underscore the incredible money given to some individuals for their athletic talents. But while the possibility of staggering wealth and status through sport is possible, the reality is that dramatic upward mobility through sport is highly improbable. The number of myths, however, combine us to believe that sport is a social mobility escalator. Myth: sport provides a free education. Good high school athletes get college scholarships. These athletic scholarships are especially helpful to poor youth who would otherwise not be able to attend college because of the high costs. The problem with this assumption is that while true for some, very few high school athletes actually receive full scholarships. Football provides the easiest route to college scholarship because Division I-A colleges have 85 football scholarships. But even this avenue is exceedingly narrow. In Colorado, there were 3,481 male high school seniors who played football during the 1994 season. Of these, 31 received full scholarships at Division I-A schools. That's 0.0089%. Second, of all the male varsity athletes at college levels, only about 15% to 20% have full scholarships. Another 15 to 20%, 25% have partial scholarships, leaving 55% to 70% of all intercollegiate athletes without any sport-related financial assistance. Third, as low as the chances are for men, women athletes have even less chance to receive athletic scholarship. While women comprise about 52% of all college students, they make up about 35% of intercollegiate athletes with similar disproportionate distribution of scholarships. Another reality is that if you are a male athlete in so-called minor sport, swimming, tennis, golf, gymnastics, cross-country, wrestling, the chances of a full scholarship are virtually nil. The best hope is a partial scholarship, if that, since these sports are underfunded and in danger of elimination at many schools. Myth: sport leads to a college degree. College graduates exceed high school graduates by hundreds of thousands of dollars in lifetime earnings. Since most high school and college athletes will never play at the professional level, the attainment of a college degree is a crucial determinant of upward mobility through sport. The problem is that relatively few male athletes in big-time revenue-producing sports, compared to their non-athletic peers, actually receive college degrees. This is especially the case for African-American men who are overrepresented in the revenue-producing sports. In 1996, for example, looking at the athletes who entered Division I schools in 1990, only 45% of African-American football players and 39% of African-American basketball players had graduated, compared to 56% of the general student body. There are a number of barriers to graduation for male athletes. The demands on their time and energy are enormous, even in off-season. Many athletes, because of these pressures, take easy courses to maintain eligibility but do not lead to graduation. The result is either to delay graduation or to make graduation an unrealistic goal. Another barrier is that they are recruited for athletic prowess rather than academic ability. Recent data show that football players in big-time programs are, on average, more than 200 points behind their non-athletic classmates on SAT test scores. Poorly prepared students are the most likely to take easy courses, cheat on exams, hire surrogate test takers, and otherwise do the minimum. A third barrier to graduation for male college athletes is themselves, as they may not take advantage of their scholarships to obtain a quality education. This is especially the case for those who perceive their college experience only as preparation for their professional careers in sport. Study for them is necessary only to maintain their eligibility. The goal of a professional career is unrealistic for all but the superstars. The superstars who do make it to the professional level, more likely than not, will have not graduated from college, nor will they go back to finish their degrees when the professional careers are over. This is also because even a successful professional athletic career is limited to a few years, and not many professional athletes are able to translate their success in the pros to success in their post-athletic careers. Such a problem is especially true for African Americans, who often face employment discrimination in the wider society. Myth: a sports career is probable. A recent survey by the Center of Study of Sport in Society found that two-thirds of African-American males between the age of 13 and 18 believe that they can earn a living playing professional sports, more than double the proportion of young white males who hold such beliefs. Moreover, African-American parents were four times more likely than white parents to believe that their sons are destined for careers as professional athletes. If these young athletes could play as professionals, the economic rewards are excellent, especially in basketball and baseball. In 1998, the average annual salary for professional basketball was $2.24 million. In baseball, the average salary was $1.37 million, with 280 of the 774 players on opening day rosters making $1 million or more. Of them, 197 exceeded $2 million or more, while 32 of them made $6 million or more. The average salaries for the National Hockey League and National Football League were $892,000 and $795,000, respectively. In football, for example, 19% of the players, 333 of 1,765, exceeded $1 million in salary. These numbers are inflated by the use of averages, which are skewed by the salaries of the superstars. Use of the median, in which half the players make more and half make less, reveals that the median salary in basketball was $1.4 million, baseball, $500,000, football, $400,000, and hockey, $500,000. Regardless of the measure, the financial allure of a professional sports career is great. A career in professional sports is nearly impossible to attain because of the fierce competition for so few openings. In an average year, there are approximately 1.9 million American boys playing high school football, basketball, and baseball. Another 68,000 men are playing those sports in college, and 2,490 are participating in the major professional level. In short, 1 in 27 high school players in these sports will play at the college level, and only 1 in 736 high school players will play at the major professional level, 0.14%. In baseball, each year about 120,000 players are eligible for the draft. High school seniors, college seniors, collegians over 21, junior college players, and foreign players. Only about 1,200, 1%, are actually drafted, and most of them will never make it to the major leagues. Indeed, only about 1 in 10 of those players who sign a professional baseball contract ever play in the major leagues for at least one day. The same rigorous condensation process occurs in football. About 15,000 players are eligible for the NFL draft each year. 336 are drafted, and about 160 actually make the final roster. Similarly, in basketball and hockey, only about 40 new players are added to the roster in NBA, and 60 rookies make the NHL each year. In tennis, only about 100 men and 100 women make enough money to cover expenses. In golf, of the 165 men eligible for the PGA Tour in 1997, their official winnings range from 2,066,833 for Tiger Woods to 10,653 for Chip Beck. The competition among these golfers is fierce. On average, the top 100 golfers in the tour play within two strokes of each other for every 18 holes. Yet Tiger Woods, the top in winnings, won over $2 million, and the 100th finisher won $250,000. Below the PGA Tour is the Nike Tour, where the next best 125 golfers compete. Their winnings were a top of $225,201 to a low of $9,944. Myth: women have sport as a vehicle. Since the passage of Title IX in 1972 that required schools receiving federal funds to provide equal opportunities for women and men, sports participation by women in high school and college has increased dramatically. In 1973, for example, when 50,000 men received some form of college scholarship for their athletic ability, women received only 50. Now women receive about 35% of the money allotted for college athletic scholarships. While a dramatic improvement, this should not be equated with gender equality as many would have us believe. This allows many women athletes to attend college who otherwise could not afford it, thus receiving an indirect upward mobility boost. Upward mobility as a result of being a professional athlete is another matter for women. Women have fewer opportunities than men in professional team sports. Beach volleyball is a possibility for a few, but the rewards are minimal. Two professional women's basketball leagues began in 1997, but the pay was very low compared to men, and the leagues were on shaky financial ground. The average salary in the American Basketball League was $80,000. The other option for women is to play in professional leagues in Europe, Australia, and Asia, but the pay is relatively low. Women have more opportunity as professionals in individual sports such as tennis, golf, ice skating, skiing, bowling, cycling, and track. Ironically, the sports with the greatest monetary rewards for women are those in the middle and upper classes: tennis, golf, and ice skating. These sports are expensive and require considerable individual coaching and access to private facilities. Ironically, with the passage of Title IX, which increased the participation rates of women so dramatically, there's been a decline in the number and proportion of women as coaches and athletic administrators. In addition to the glaring pay gap between the coaches of men's teams receive compared to the coaches of women's teams, men who coach women's teams tend to have higher salaries than women coaching women's teams. Women also have fewer opportunities than men as athletic trainers, officials, sports journalists, and other adjunct positions. Myth: sports provides lifelong security. Even when a professional sports career is attained, the probabilities of fame and fortune are limited. Of course, some athletes make incomes from salaries and endorsements that, if invested wisely, provide financial security for life. Many professional athletes make relatively low salaries. During the 1996 season, for example, 17% of Major League Baseball players made the minimum salary of $247,500 for veterans and $220,000 for rookies. This is a lot of money, but for the marginal players, their careers may not last very long. Indeed, the average length for a professional career in a team sport is about 5 years. A marginal athlete in individual sports such as golf, tennis, boxing, and bowling struggles financially. They must cover their travel expenses, health insurance, equipment, and the like with no guaranteed paycheck. The brief career diverts them in their youth from developing other career skills and experiences that would benefit them. Ex-professional athletes leave sport on average when they're in their late 20s or early 30s, at a time when their non-athletic peers have begun to establish themselves in occupations leading toward retirement in 40 years or so. What do the ex-professional athletes do with their remaining productive years? Exiting a sports career can be relatively smooth or difficult. Some athletes have planned ahead, preparing for other careers either in sport, coaching, scouting, administering, or some other non-sport occupation. Others have not prepared for this abrupt change. They did not graduate from college. They did not spend the off-season apprenticing non-sport jobs. Exiting the athletic role is difficult for many because they lose, one, what they had been their focus for most of their lives, two, the primary source of their identities, three, their physical prowess, four, the adulation bordering on worship from others, five, the money and the prerequisites of fame, six, the camaraderie with teammates, seven, the intense highs of competition, and eight, for most ex-athletes, retirement means a loss of status. As a result of these losses, many ex-professional athletes have trouble adjusting to life after sport. A study by the NFL Players Association found that emotional difficulties, divorce, and financial strain were common problems for ex-professional football players. A majority had permanent injuries from football. The allure of sport, however, remains strong, and this has at least two negative consequences. First, ghetto youngsters who devote their lives to the pursuit of athletic stardom are, except for the fortunate few, doomed to failure in sport in the real world, where sports skills are essentially irrelevant to occupational placement and advancement. The second negative consequence is more subtle but very important. Sports contributes to the ideology that legitimizes social inequalities and promotes the myth that all it takes is extraordinary effort to succeed. Sports sociologist George H. Sage makes this point forcefully. Because sport is by nature meritocratic, that is, superior performance brings status and rewards, it provides convincing symbolic support for hegemonic, the dominant ideology that ambitious, dedicated, hardworking individuals, regardless of social origin, can achieve success and ascend in the social hierarchy, obtaining high status and material rewards. While those who don't move upward simply didn't work hard enough. Because the rags-to-riches athletes are so visible, the social mobility theme is maintained. This reflects the opportunity structure of society in general. The success of a few reproduces the belief in social mobility among the many. Myth: sport is a way out of poverty. Sport appears to be a major way for African Americans to escape the ghetto. African Americans dominate the major professional sports numerically. While only 12% of the population, African Americans comprise about 80% of the players in professional basketball, about 67% of professional football players, and 18% of professional baseball players. Latinos also comprise about 17% of professional baseball players. Moreover, African Americans dominate the list of highest moneymakers in sport, salaries, commercial sponsorships. These facts, while true, are illusory. While African Americans dominate the professional basketball, football, and to a lesser extent, baseball, they are rarely found in certain sports such as hockey, automobile racing, tennis, golf, bowling, and skiing. Moreover, African Americans are severely underrepresented in positions of authority in sport as head coaches, referees, athletic directors, scouts, general managers, and owners. In the NFL in 1997, for example, where more than two-thirds of the players were African American, only 3 head coaches and 5 offensive or defensive coordinators were African American. In that year, there were 11 head coaching vacancies filled, none by African Americans. The reason for this racial imbalance in hiring, according to the white sports columnist for the Rocky Mountain News, Bob Kravitz, is that something here stinks, and it stinks a lot like racism. Second, while the odds of African American males making it as professional athletes are more favorable than is the case for whites, about 1 in 3,500 African American male high school athletes compared to 1 in 10,000 white male high school athletes, these odds remain slim. Of the 40,000 or so African American boys who play high school basketball, only 35 will make the NBA, and only 7 will be starters. Referring to the low odds for young African Americans, Harry Edwards, an African American sociologist specializing in the sociology of sport, said with a bit of hyperbole, "Statistically, you have a better chance of getting hit by a meteorite in the next 10 years than getting work as an athlete." Despite these discouraging facts, the myth is alive for poor youth. As noted earlier, two-thirds of African-American boys believe they can be professional athletes. Their parents, too, accept this belief. African-American parents are 4 times more likely than white parents to believe that their children will be professional athletes. The film Hoop Dreams and Darcy Frey's book The Last Shot, City Street, Basketball Dreams document the emphasis that young African-American men place on sports as a way up and their ultimate disappointments from sports. For many of them, sports represents their only hope of escape from a life of crime, poverty, and despair. They latch onto the dream of athletic success partly because of the few opportunities for middle-class success. They spend many hours per day developing their speed, strength, jumping height, or moves to the virtual exclusion of those abilities that have a greater likelihood of paying off in upward mobility, such as reading comprehension, mathematical reasoning, communication skills, and computer literacy. Sociologist Jay Coakley put it this way: "My best guess is that less than 3,500 African Americans are making their livings as professional athletes. At the same time in 1996, there were about 30,015 black physicians and about 30,800 black lawyers currently employed in the U.S. Therefore, there are 20 times more blacks working in these two professions than playing the top-level professional sports. And physicians and lawyers usually have lifetime earnings far in excess of the earnings of professional athletes, whose paying careers on average last less than 5 years. Harry Edwards posits that by spending their energies and talents on athletic skills, young African Americans are not pursuing occupations that would help them meet their political and material needs. Thus, because of the belief in sports as a way up myth, they remain dependent on whites and white institutions. Salim Muwakkil, an African American political analyst, argues that if African Americans are to exploit the socioeconomic opinions opened by varied civil rights struggles more fully, blacks must reduce the disproportionate allure of sports in their communities. Black leadership must contextualize athletic success by promoting other avenues to social status, intensifying the struggle for access for those avenues, and better educating youth about these potholes, the road to the stadium. John Hoberman, in his book Darwin's Athletes, also challenged the assumptions that sports has progressive consequences. The success of African Americans in highly visible sports gives white Americans a false sense of black progress and interracial harmony. But the social progress of African Americans in general has little relationship to the apparent integration that they've achieved on the playing fields. Hoberman also contends that the numerical superiority of African Americans in sport, coupled with their disproportionate underrepresentation in other professions, reinforces the racist ideology that African Americans, while physically superior to whites, are inferior to them intellectually. I do not mean to say that African Americans should not seek a career in professional sport. What is harmful is that the odds to success are so slim, making the extraordinary efforts over many years futile and misguided for the vast majority.